Bob Feller Show. Program 21. Ernie Calvary. The basketball of today is dominated by the big man. But as long as the game is played, there will always be a place for the little guy. This is a story about a basketball player named Ernie Calvary who played at Rhode Island State. Ernie was only 5 foot 10 inches tall and weighed a wee 140 pounds. But oh, how he could shoot. He was a small man in the middle 1940s, so you can imagine how he would stack up in today's game of giants. Rhode Island earned a berth in the 1946 National Invitation Tourney at New York's Madison Square Garden. The NIT, as it is popularly known, is one of the top attractions of the basketball season. Rhode Island was paired against tall and talented Bowling Green of Kentucky in the opening round, and the New England team was considered the underdog. 6'11" Don Otten was the scoring star of Bowling Green, and it was a mild surprise as Rhode Island held a slim 34-32 lead as the team left the court at the halftime intermission. How long would it take before Bowling Green's superiority took its toll? The fans wondered, so did the coaches. But the Rhode Island coach had one ace in the hole, his sharp-shooting little guard, Ernie Calvary. Ernie was the reason why Rhode Island was still in the game. The second half opened and the two schools matched basket for basket. Neither side could move to any kind of a lead. Otten was controlling the boards for the bigger Bowling Green quintet, but Calvary was picking up support from Garden fans with his one-handed shots, his ball hawking, and his all-around ability to keep his club in the game. The game moved along. Rhode Island in the lead, then Bowling Green. Then, with the clock showing only 3 minutes and 20 seconds to play, Otten fouled out. A break for Rhode Island. The big guy had scored 31 points and pulled down almost as many rebounds. Ernie and his teammates had received new hope now. Calvary had the ball. 1 minute and 10 seconds remained. Ernie shot. The ball switched to the nets. The score was tied at 72-72. Bowling Green decided to play for only one shot. Bowling Green team didn't want to make any mistakes. One shot was all it needed. Rhode Island didn't want to foul and send a player to the free throw line. The clock showed just 10 seconds of play. Vern Dunham drove for the basket. The shot was good. Bowling Green led 74-72. Rhode Island had the ball and moved down court. A whistle. A Rhode Island player had been fouled, but Rhode Island waived the foul. Only 2 seconds remained. We'll be back in 60 seconds for the thrilling windup. Ernie Calvary was a marked man as the teams lined up. 2 Bowling Green players guarded him, but Ernie was a man for the final shot. He took the pass from out of bounds, whirled, and fired a long desperation shot. As the ball sailed high into the air, the buzzer sounded. The ball finally came down and through the nets. It was good. Ernie Calvary had tied the game with a 55-foot desperation shot at the buzzer, one of the greatest shots in basketball history. Rhode Island went on to beat Bowling Green in overtime, and it reached the final round, only to lose to Kentucky. But to some 18,000 basketball fans, the biggest thrill of the 1946 tourney came when a little guy named Calvary tossed in an almost unbelievable shot that took Rhode Island to the finals of the NIT. Bob Feller Show, Program 22. So many great stories have been told about the Kentucky Derby, and this is one of the finest. It all started with a horse by the name of Aristides in 1875. Horses like the import Omar Khayyam in 1917 won the famed Run for the Roses at Louisville, Kentucky. Other horses like 20 Grand, Omaha, War Admiral, Whirlaway, Count Fleet, Assault, and Citation have been in the winner's circle. And when it comes to jockeys, the list naturally is just as long. Riders like Eddie Arcaro, Ted Atkinson, to name a couple. This is not a story about Arcaro or War Admiral or Citation, but it's about a great jockey of another era and about a horse he rode in the 1930 Kentucky Derby. Right now, we won't mention the jockey's name or the horse he rode that day. Our story goes back a bit further than the 1930 Kentucky Derby. In the late 20s, this jockey had a problem to keep his weight down. Finally, he decided to call it quits on the track and become an owner. But his problems only started then. He lost money, plenty of it. He knew then that his business was aboard a horse. So as it would happen, this jockey was aboard a favorite in the 1930 Kentucky Derby. 15 horses were in the Derby field that day. As the horses passed the grandstand for the first time, the favorite was in fifth place. As the field rounded the first turn, the jockey inched his mount closer to the leaders. There was still a long race ahead. But the jockey wanted to give his mount a little push to see if he was in a running mood. The jockey knew his horse had it. In fact, he had to hold him back. A filly was in the lead as the horses moved down the backstretch. The jockey let his mount move ahead of the filly. Near the end of the stretch, another horse, Crack Brigade, made a move. The jockey let the other mount get within a length or so, then urged his horse on again. He didn't need much urging. Into the far turn, the favorite began to open a big lead. Into the stretch, another horse, Gallant Knight, made a bid. But it was in vain. The jockey of our story and his horse moved closer to the finish line and across it, a comfortable two lengths in front of the second horse. It was a popular victory, a great comeback for a famous jockey. In 60 seconds, we'll return to find out who the jockey was. The race so inspired a sports writer in the press box that the writer, the late Damon Runyon, scribbled this poem. Say, have they turned the pages back to the past once more? Back to the race in ages, and a derby out of the yore. Say, don't tell me I'm daffy. Ain't that the same old grin? Why, it's that guy named Sandy, booting a winner in. Earl Sandy had made his comeback aboard a horse named Gallant Fox. Bob Feller Show, program number 23. It's difficult to pinpoint the toughest situation for a pitcher. Naturally, a bases-loaded, no-out situation in the bottom of the ninth would be a nightmare for any pitcher. But how about a pitcher who must join his club late in the season after, say, 4 years in the service? No spring training, no exhibitions, no major league tune-ups of any kind. Well, I know how it feels, because I was in that kind of a situation August 14th, 1945. I was back in my club, the Cleveland Indians, and my manager, Lou Boudreau, nominated me to face the league-leading Detroit Tigers. I took my warm-up pitches, and I knew I'd find out soon enough if I had it. The first Detroit batter, Jimmy Outlaw, was a strikeout victim. I felt good. The second batter was out on a fly to center field. Then Doc Kramer caught hold of one of my fastballs and sent it to the deep right center for a triple. Hank Greenberg was the next batter. I knew I had my work cut out for me. I worked especially hard on Hank. I slipped a strike past him, then made him swing and miss one. Another pitch, and Greenberg was caught looking. The inning was over, and Kramer was stranded on third. I had my first test, but there were eight more innings to go. My teammates touched opposing pitcher Hal Newhouser for two runs in our half of the first inning. My control was a bit shaky as I faced the Tigers in the second inning, and I walked the first two batters. Long ball hitting Rudy York was the next batter. I threw hard, and Rudy swung and missed. Then another strike, and finally a third. I had two more outs to go before I could get out of the inning safely. The next batter was a pop-up, and so was the other. Paul Richards, now general manager of the Houston Colts, was the first Tiger batter in the third, and he doubled. I walked the next batter. There was some activity in the Indian bullpen, and I knew it. I had to get out of this trouble myself, but a single scored one run, and another hit sent the tying run across. Somehow, I finished the inning without any more scoring. It was now 2-2, a brand new ball game. My teammates got me a run in the third inning, and I was determined now to go all the way and win this one. I set the Tigers down without a hit in the fourth, then the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. I was really rolling along. But I still had the ninth inning to go. In 60 seconds, I'll be back for the final inning of a game I will always remember. My teammates had picked up another run for me, and the Indians led 4-2 as I went to the mound for the ninth inning. I retired the first batter. Now I had two to go. The second man was a strikeout victim. My fastball was sizzling, and my arm appeared to be getting stronger as the innings rolled along. Leadoff man Jimmy Outlaw was next. I reared back and fired. He swung and missed. The next pitch tipped the outside corner for a called strike. Only one more to go. I was ready, but so was Outlaw. The pitch, strike three. My return from the war was a big success. I knew then I still had a lot of good pitching left in my right arm, and the almost 4-year hitch in the Navy did not hurt me.
Bob Feller Show, program number 24.
For Yankee fans, a fall is not complete unless their club is in the World Series. For other American League hopefuls, the years drag on and on without a representative in the Fall Classic. The year 1959 is one year that fans in the Windy City of Chicago will never forget. And one season the Yankee fans would like to forget. The White Sox and the Cleveland Indians were in a struggle for first place. The Yankees had already been eliminated. Bill Veeck, one of baseball's most colorful officials, was president of the White Sox. Fans couldn't keep up with their stunts and attractions offered by Veeck during the 1959 campaign. But the best of all, the team was winning. When the White Sox pulled into Cleveland one evening in September, they sported a 3.5-game lead over the Indians. This was it. A victory over the Indians, and the so-called magic number would be zero. The Indians still had a chance to overtake the White Sox, but they couldn't afford to lose another game. More than 54,000 fans jammed Municipal Stadium in Cleveland. Thousands of others back in Chicago watched and listened to the game on television and radio. Manager Al Lopez decided to go with his ace early win for the big one. Cleveland manager Joe Gordon named the young right-hander Jim Perry. Wynn had some anxious moments in the second inning. Minnie Minosa was on third base, and Rocky Colavito was a batter. Colavito swung and sent a fly ball to left field. Al Smith camped under it, but he knew the speedy Minosa represented a lead run for the Indians. Smith caught the ball and on the run fired to catcher Johnny Romano. The young backstop flicked the throw and tagged Minosa out of the plate. The Sox tagged Perry for a couple of runs in the third inning. Louis Aparicio sent one run across with a double and scored on a double by Billy Goodman. The Sox had confidence now as they took the field for the fourth inning. Wynn was in trouble in the fifth, but escaped with only one Indian tally. Jim Grant was on the mound for the Indians in the sixth, and Al Smith and Jim Rivera greeted him with homers. As the ninth inning approached, the Sox had a 4-2 lead. Bob Shaw had replaced Wynn on the mound. In 60 seconds, we'll be back for the exciting ninth inning. Shaw retired leadoff batter Woody Hale on a pop-up, but Jim Baxter singled off the pitcher's glove, and relief hitter Jack Harshman followed with a single to right. Jimmy Pearsall was next, and he sent a liner that Nellie Fox knocked down to second base. The runner held third. The bases were loaded. Manager Lopez took the slow walk to the mound. He singled for Jerry Steele, the 39-year-old relief ace. It was Steele's 65th appearance of the season. But no appearance could be as important as this one. Vic Power was the first batter to face Steele. He knew that one pitch could make the difference between victory and defeat. Power swung at the first pitch and grounded to Aparicio at short. Then Louis scooped it up, touched second base for the force, and fired to Kuzuski at first to complete a double play. The game was over. The White Sox had won 4-2. And back in Chicago, air raid sirens signaled the first White Sox pennant in 40 years. Bob Feller Show, Program 25. The United States has never lost a basketball game in Olympic competition. Uncle Sam's quintets are taller and much more talented than their foes from around the globe. In some cases, the games are a foregone conclusion before or soon after the opening whistle. 1948 was Olympic year. 8 teams were entered in the Olympic trials. But the team to represent Uncle Sam would come mainly from the winner of the trials. The basketball experts had been right. The two teams they picked to meet in the finals were in the finals. The contest was billed as a dream game. It matched Adolph Rupp's great Kentucky team against the Phillips Oilers, the champions of AAU basketball. Ralph Beard, Alex Groza, and Wawa Jones were the stars of the Kentucky team, but the rival Oilers had the height and were led by 7-foot Bob Curlin, a former All-American from Oklahoma A&M. The game promised to be a thriller. More than 18,000 fans jammed New York's Madison Square Garden on a March evening, and the Oilers were tabbed as a slight favorite. The Wildcats were hot from the outside early in the contest. Beard would hit for a long one, then Jones connected. They built up a 20-13 lead as college fans and the big crowd cheered. But the veteran AAU team wouldn't be denied. It ripped off 11 straight points to take the lead. Another long set shot by Beard, and the first half ended in a 26-26 deadlock. What promised to be a great game was just that, but Kentucky had bad news at the halftime. Another star, Cliff Barker, suffered a broken nose, and Jones had fouled out. Soon after the start of the second half, it looked like the end of the collegians. the Oilers reel off 11 points to only one for the Wildcats and sport a 37-27 lead. But Kentucky wouldn't give up. Groza matched Curlin underneath the basket, and Beard fired away from the field. The Oilers lead was cut to only 1 point. Could the Collegians make it? We'll be back in 60 seconds to find out. The superior Oilers height started to tell. Curlin hit from underneath, then hooked in a shot. The Oilers are back in the lead. Only 2 minutes remained on the clock as the teams traded baskets. The Garden went wild, but the Wildcats fouled their opponents in their bid to get control of the ball. Bob Feller Show, program 26. Lou Gehrig was one of the great stars of baseball, but during his career, he played in a lineup with another great, Babe Ruth. So, as it would happen, Gehrig played in the shadow of the great Babe. Even when Lou had a great day, and he did on June 3rd, 1932, another story would overshadow his feats. But let's not get too far ahead of our story. The New York Yankees faced the old Philadelphia Athletics at Philadelphia, and it was one of those days when the pitchers should have stayed in bed. It just wasn't a day for pitchers. Gehrig started a slugfest with a home run with one teammate aboard in the first inning. But A's catcher Mickey Cochran, another all-time great star, evened the score at 2-2 with a homer in the bottom of the first. Gehrig was back at the plate in the third inning with one teammate on base. Lou picked out another fat one and headed into the stands. Another homer, and the Yankees had a 4-2 lead. But it didn't last long. The home side bounced back and knocked the Yankees starter out of the box with six big runs in the fourth inning to take an 8-4 lead. The Yankee power sent the A's pitcher to the showers as Earl Coombs and Babe Ruth smacked homers in the fifth. That brought Gehrig to the plate for the third time. Fans wondered when the bombing would stop, but it didn't stop with Gehrig. He picked out the first pitch and sent it deep into the stands. Three homers for the popular first baseman. Runs crossed the plate for both sides in the sixth inning. The scoreboard showed the A's ahead 10-9 as Yankee fans took their seventh inning stretch. Gehrig was one of the Yankee batters in the seventh, and a lot of fans shouted for Lou to smack another homer. He did. Now it was all even at 10-10. He had equaled a major league record for one game with his seventh inning blast. But would he get another chance to bat and set a major league mark of five homers in one game? The Yankees tallied two runs to take a 12-10 lead in the eighth inning. There was a possibility that Gehrig would get another crack at the ball. The Yankees exploded their power in the ninth. Tony Nazario hit a grand slam homer, and it was now 18-10, but the inning wasn't over. Gehrig had another chance at bat. In 60 seconds, we'll be back to find out how he fared. Lou waited for the first pitch and swung. It was a long blast, but would it be long enough? Philadelphia outfielder Al Simmons was off with a crack of the bat. At the last second, he jumped and grabbed the ball in front of the wall. A great catch had robbed Lou of a record-setting homer, but still, it was quite an effort. The Yanks won the game, and Gehrig had hit four home runs. But there's an ironic touch to our story. Instead of Gehrig's four home runs making big sport headlines, it was just another story. Why? Well, a man by the name of John McGraw made even bigger headlines. You see, this was a day that McGraw announced his resignation as manager of the New York Giants after 30 years. Yes, Lou Gehrig's great feats were always overshadowed, but baseball fans will never forget him. He was not only a great ball player, but a great American.